Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Anne Boyd Rue, whose new biography is Constance Fenimore Woolson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist. We'll also hear from Chris Offit, author of My Father, the Pornographer, a memoir. Anne Boyd Rue is a professor of English at the University of New Orleans and the author of two previous books, Wielding the Pen, Writings on Authorship by American Women of the 19th Century, and Writing for Immortality, Women and the Emergence of High Literary Culture in America. Her new book is Constance Fenimore Woolson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist. She's also the editor of Miss Grief and Other Stories, a collection of stories by Constance Fenimore Woolson. Anne Boyd Rue, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Oh, you have been at work on this for so long, and now Here it is at last. But unfortunately, Constance Fenimore Woolson isn't exactly a household name. So tell us a little bit about her. Place her in context for us.
That's the reason I wanted to write the book in the first place, which makes it sound like a hard sell. How are you going to write a biography about somebody that nobody knows about? But she's someone that I encountered in my graduate studies. In fact, I found her on my own. So she wasn't taught to me in any graduate class. And I stumbled upon her in the library one day and just fell in love. And there was this wonderful collection of stories called Women Artists, Women Exiles that had been published, you know, in the 80s. And that kind of became my Bible for a while. And she was in my first book. So I wrote a book that you mentioned, Writing for Immortality, that's about the first generation of American women writers to view themselves as serious artists. And she was one of the four, and she kind of stuck with me always as probably the most ambitious and the most accomplished of the four, because the others pretty much gave up their careers at some point. Either they stopped and had a family, or maybe they became children's writers, like Louisa May Alcott. She was one of the four that I wrote about. And so their careers took a different turn, but she really stayed on that track. And she was, I would say, probably the most highly regarded American woman writer of the late 19th century. Yet she wasn't being taught. And that wonderful collection of stories that I found, it went out of print. And there's been no collection to replace it. And so I've been a member of the Woolson Society. So there's a society of scholars. We get together every 2 years and we have these wonderful conferences. But it felt like we were this insular bubble, right? And nobody else was really paying much attention. And we were the ones who were producing the scholarship on her. And she'd gotten into the literature anthologies, but then she started falling out of the anthologies. And so it felt like she could disappear all over again. So that's why writing the biography became so important to me.
And it's so tragic that she wrote so much, so many novels, so many short stories. She was a best-selling author in her time, and yet she's been primarily remembered for her friendship with Henry James.
Right. So the friendship with Henry James has been, I think, a blessing and a curse. A blessing in the sense that it has kept her name alive during long stretches when maybe she would have been forgotten. His biographer, Leon Edel, who wrote that massive five-volume biography, kind of resurrected her in some ways. But when he did that, he cast her as a kind of hanger-on, a sort of second-rate writer. And he couldn't understand what James saw in her. You know, why did he write an appreciative essay of her? And why was that the only other American writer besides Emerson that he included in his collection, Partial Portraits, a collection of his criticism? And Edel was kind of mystified, at least in print. But I've read his letters that he wrote to Woolson's niece, who was still living, and he admired her very much. In fact, he was thinking he wanted to write a biography of her when he was done with James. But then by the time, you know, decades later, when the books finally made it into print, suddenly, you know, she was this magazine-ish writer, he called her, of little significance. And so all these Woolson scholars kind of came out of that movement of feminist literary criticism and tried to resurrect her. And many of them, in fact, first learned about her through their study of Henry James. So blessing and a curse, mm-hmm. I would say.
So you've put so much time and energy into rescuing her from obscurity. So tell us about how it is that her work speaks to you. What is it in her work that merits this longstanding affection?
Yeah, it's been hard for me to put my finger on that, but I realized that the thing that Wilson valued in writing of her day, like what she was really trying to accomplish, and I think she did achieve it, was to make readers feel for their characters, right? Once you kind of get in their experience, and she writes about such odd sort of marginal characters sometimes, and they're characters that people at the time wouldn't have paid much attention to in real life, right? And yet here she is bringing them into their living rooms through these magazine stories, and not only making them look at these characters, but really get inside these characters and feel, you know, what it's like to be a spinster, for instance, who's struggling to be a writer. She has that great story, Miss Grief. And that is a story that has been most often anthologized, but has started falling out of the anthologies again. I guess the stories still have the capacity to touch the reader and make you feel what these characters are feeling. And to me, that is the highest goal of what literature should do. Mm-hmm. And her stories are still able to do that, what, 170 years after her death.
Some of these stories are just heartbreaking. I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So how did editing her short fiction for this new book come about? You know, was that always the plan to have the biography and Miss Grief and other stories come out at the same time?
It wasn't always the plan. The biography was sold first. And then I started talking to my editor at Norton, Amy Cherry, about, you know, maybe doing a collection of stories. And I talked to other editors, too, and was really gratified to see that, you know, other presses were interested, too, that they were convinced by the work I was doing on the biography and by reading some of the stories that I sent to them that she deserved to be in print again. And I was really happy that Norton wanted to put together this collection to come out with the biography. And it was very satisfying to me because that collection of stories that I love so much of hers had gone out of print. Now, this is a very different kind of collection. So what I'm trying to do here is to give a sense of the breadth of her career. And so we have stories from the early years of her career when she's writing about the Great Lakes. So she grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and she spent summers on Mackinac Island, the tip of Michigan, and along the shores of Lake Erie, Lake Huron, you know, all these Great Lakes. And so these stories really grow out of those experiences. And also she spent time in Zoar, Ohio. That's a wonderful kind of Amish community. It was a religious separatist community that felt like stepping back in time or going to Europe. And she spent a lot of time there with her father on vacations. So those early stories were really just the beginning of her career. And then she moved south after the Civil War with her mother. Her mother was an invalid. Her health was failing. And so she took her down south during the era of Reconstruction. And they spent their winters in St. Augustine, Florida. And they had these wonderful encounters with Southerners that Wilson is able to bring into her collection of stories. Robin the Keeper was the name of the collection. And that title story is in this collection that I've put together. It's really one of the few stories that I think successfully dramatizes the tensions that lingered after the Civil War between North and South. Walt Whitman said the Civil War will never get in the books, and maybe it never did, but the aftermath of the war, Wilson did get in the books, and she was writing about Reconstruction in a way that no other writer of that period was. And so that's reflected in the collection. But then after her mother died, she moved to Europe. And so she spent the last 14 years of her life living in England, Italy, Switzerland. She even made it as far as Cairo and the Holy Land. So she was a big traveler. And her stories, she set some of her later stories in Italy. And then the final story is set in England. And that story's never been reprinted before.
Nobody would ever call her a regional writer. Nobody would make that mistake.
Right.
Know?
I mean, she was a pioneer regionalist, right? Her first collection of Great Lakes stories was very significant, one of the earliest collections of regionalist stories. But yeah, you can't pin her down to one
She's
particular
all over the
region.
Place.
She's not like Kate Chopin, this Louisiana writer. She's all over the place. And I think in some ways that has hurt her in terms of, you know, her lasting reputation, because you can't identify her with one place. But to me, that's what makes her career so exciting, was that she was writing about so many different places. So you really get this snapshot by reading these stories of what it was like to be an American living in all these different places, all these different tensions that people are encountering as they move across regions. And then as they're going to Europe and encountering Europeans.
And being a single woman, the other thing that you bring home, it's such a nice way and a kind way, is that she was deaf. And that's a kind of social barrier to so much experience. And also writing itself in that time, this is one of the fascinating things to me, was such hard work.
Such hard physical work.
It was. And so she's writing these long, sprawling Victorian novels, multiple drafts, and she had to stand. After a while, she realized that she's having such trouble with her back. So she stood at a desk for sometimes 14 hours a day, and her arm was lame at times. You know, other writers of the era, like Louise May Alcott, had to learn how to write with their other hand, right, because the writing was so difficult. Henry James was able to hire someone to dictate his novels to.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, right.
I could just imagine how she felt when he told her that. You know,
she wanted one, too.
Yeah, of course.
But she couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. What is really sad about her life is that she couldn't keep writing, right? And that meant everything to her. Physically, it became just impossible to carry on in this way because it was so grueling physically.
And she had so many strains of difficulty running through her family. There were money problems. There were suicides and depression. And eventually, she herself died in that way.
Probably. We don't know for sure, right? There's no definitive evidence. There's no suicide note. In fact, she was adamant, because she was ill at the end of her life, that she wanted to leave a will. And she never wrote a will. She definitely was suicidal, though. She had suicidal thoughts. She'd contemplated it early in her life. And she wrote about characters who felt suicidal. And her brother committed suicide, right? So it's not beyond the realm of possibility. In fact, it's very possible.
So tell me, it's such a labor of love to write a book like this. It's years of your life. What is it about her that informs your life?
Well, it's an interesting question and one that I've thought about. Part of it is just frankly that, you know, I fell in love with her. I thought she was this amazing, beautiful person. I would have loved to have known her. If I'd known her in real life, we would have been dear friends. The more I learned about her, the more I admired her. And I know that's not always the case for biographers because we're only human, right? You're going to dig up stuff.
Yeah.
But with her, the more I found out, the more sympathy and empathy I felt for her and admiration, really. Even though she had a very difficult life, right? I mean, she grew up in a time when she was raised to be a very traditional, conventional woman. The goal of her life was to have children, to be married, to have a home, and she didn't have any of that. Her career as a writer was a great compensation. Her ability to travel was a great compensation, but she always felt that loss. So she was really forging a new identity for herself and a path in life that really only men had led up until that point. And it was lonely, as you said. The deafness made her very lonely. She lost family members. She lost that connection to her home. It was all very difficult. But at the same time, she had this just wonderful tenacity. I mean, she survived through all of that. And not only that, but she had a tremendous capacity for joy, even in the midst of all of that. When I saw the home that she lived in Florence on the hill of Bellasguardo and saw that amazing view that she lived with for 3 years, I knew that she'd had some really happy times in her life, and I was happy for her.
Well, that's consoling. It's such a wonderful biography, and then to read her work. It's just a great reintroduction of this writer.
Well, I hope that people feel that way. I certainly do.
Oh, I did too. We've been talking with Anne Boyd Rue, whose new book is Constance Fenimore Woolson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist. You can meet her Thursday, March 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, March 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library, talking about why the history of women writers matters. She'll also be appearing at the 30th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival coming up at the end of March. Anne, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Chris Offutt is an award-winning author and screenwriter. You may know him from his fiction, Kentucky Straight, Out of the Woods, or his memoirs, The Same River Twice, and No Heroes, A Memoir of Coming Home. Or you might remember some of his work on the television series True Blood, Weeds, or Tremé. His most recent book is a stunning work called My Father, the Pornographer, A Memoir. We're talking to Chris today from his home near Oxford, Mississippi. Chris Offutt, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's nice to be on here.
Now, I just have to say this. Many people inherit all kinds of strange things when parents die, but you, sir, you take the cake. 1,800 pounds of pornography. The entire record of your father's writing life.
That's right. I think in the long run, I may have preferred, you know, money and land.
Of course.
Or a car. But this is what I wound up with.
Oh, yeah. And how you dealt with it is quite a story. Now, you'd always known your dad, Andy Offutt, as an insurance salesman turned writer. But had you really realized the range of what he'd done?
Not at all. He had always wanted to be a science fiction writer and started publishing in the 50s and then in the 60s and into the 70s. And that's what I thought he did. He published 30 novels of fantasy and science fiction. So that was his public persona, and it wasn't a lie because he was doing it. I mean, as a kid, I believed that that was the case. That's what he was doing all the time. I did not realize that he was writing pornography or as fast as he did, the kind of, like you said, the range.
Now, you dedicate this book to many, many people. So tell us about all those names that appear on the dedication page.
Those are Dad's pseudonyms. He had 17 pseudonyms. So I thought that would be a cool way to just sort of introduce the book and to dedicate it. Dad didn't see it, though, as him having 17 pseudonyms. His view was he had an alter ego named John Cleave. And John Cleave wrote all the porn. And it was John Cleave who had the 16 pseudonyms.
And then, of course, because he had such fame as a science fiction writer, he began to kind of come out as a porn writer.
The Cons was the only place where he could allow that information to be known. They were not in our small town and in our conservative community in eastern Kentucky in the hills. And he enjoyed the attention he got from it. Science fiction writers and readers were not judgmental about the content or about the porn. In fact, science fiction had been ignored for so many years by the mainstream literary community that there was a lot of freedom over there. And because it was science fiction, in other words, it was work that was set in the future, they could get away with exploring more sexual practices, for example, that was maybe taboo in contemporary life, but presumably would be accepted in the future. As an example, the first television interracial kiss was on Star Trek.
Right, I remember.
So, yeah, I think it was Kirk and Lieutenant Uhuru.
Mm-hmm.
So they could do that on TV because it was in the future and not today.
Amazing.
So I guess back to the Cons, though. Many science fiction writers were also writing this porn and for the money, and Dad was able to reveal himself in that world exclusively, really.
And he wrote so much of so many different types that you came up with all these categories as you were looking through his books.
He was prolific. I mean, he would write sometimes two books a month. His record was one book in 3 days. So I think at a point he really enjoyed it, and to entertain himself, he just began inventing more and more subgenres, and then bringing various other genres in. So there was horror, porn with horror in it, historical, he loved that, medieval, certainly spacecraft. There's a porn novel set in Atlantis, which was, I don't know if it was my favorite book, but it's certainly my favorite setting.
And then there were farms and cowboys and Hollywood.
Yes, all that. Whatever would get his attention, he thought would sustain him for 180 pages or 160 pages. He would go for it, and he did.
Now, you write about the deadening effect that reading all this had on you personally, and you finally just had to stop, right?
Well, I think I just got porned out, is how I put it.
Mm-hmm.
It was an overdose, really, of this material in every way, books and magazines and postcards that went back 50 years. And the cataloging of it, it was exhausting itself, sort of the archiving of this material, figuring out how to archive it and put it together. And then at a certain point, yes, I was exhausted from it. I had no more interest in it. But in the meantime, I had 400 pages that I'd written about the process and Dad and what I discovered. You know, I didn't set out to write the book. I set out to assemble a bibliography for my father. And then after a couple of years, I just gave up. I mean, I had done everything I could and was tired and had this manuscript and went back and cut 150 pages from it and tried to organize it into a coherent narrative.
Now, one of the main impetuses for your father's favored pace of writing, because he felt this, continued strain, was your orthodontia.
Well, that's what they say.
I know.
I've always wondered if it's true. I think that there is some truth to it, but I also think they were probably looking for an excuse. So certainly Dad was. He He was miserable selling insurance. He wanted to be a writer. And this gave him the sudden financial need and mom wanting to go to work outside of the house. Dad was opposed to that. You know, they were very traditional that way. But if she typed all of his manuscripts, then he wouldn't have to, and he could get two books out a month instead of the one that he was able to do on his own, plus sell insurance. I mean, he worked all the time. So there's some truth to that story. It could also be apocryphal, but it is certainly something that both my mother and father have told me repeatedly.
And then later on, when your sons need college tuition, you turn to screenwriting. So it's like the never-ending circle, you know?
It's very similar. In fact, my approach to Hollywood was similar to Dad's approach to porn, which is there is a sudden demand. You know, television is very popular now. There's, you know, more networks, more venues for content. And they need writers in the same way that porn opened up in the 70s, and there's just this enormous demand. So that was kind of right time, right place. The difference is I got into Hollywood to make money to send my sons to college, and when I graduated, I left and moved to Mississippi.
Right.
Dad got into porn, and with many of his colleagues from science fiction, they all returned to science fiction when the science fiction markets began to open up and develop again, and Dad didn't. He stayed in porn. He liked it. He liked porn more than I liked Hollywood.
Right. Whenever you read a memoir, I mean, I think memoirs are so... The really great ones are so hard to write. And this is a book that is a record of so much pain, really. Separation, you know, family secrets, the sheer relentless effort of having to deal with all these books, all this paper. And it must have taken so much out of you to write this.
Well, it was exhausting in every way, psychologically, emotionally, even physically. I worked about, you know, 10 to 14 hours a day in my house, and that's all I did, really, was sort of occupy my father's archive and then enter his mind to a certain degree, while also re-experiencing many memories from my childhood. So, yeah, it was pretty tiring. You know, I gained weight, and I started smoking again, so neither of those are great outcomes of this project.
Oh, but such a labor of love, truly. Now, before we go, could I ask you just one question about some of your Louisiana-inspired writing? Because you've worked on two of the series that are so important to us, you know, True Blood and Tremé. What has that been like for you?
The True Blood was, most of it shot in Hollywood on sets.
Right.
But they go to Shreveport every so often to shoot locations. And I was fortunate enough to be the writer who was picked to go to Shreveport for that, which irritated some of the other writers on the staff who were senior to me, but it was just happenstance. You know, and it was great. I saw family members, and I set a house on fire in the show. It was I wrote it in the script, and I thought, well, they'll never do this. And then lo and behold, they bought a condemned building and gutted it and burned it down.
Oh, the power. The power.
Yeah, it was probably the best day of my life was watching this house burn down. And then Tremé was just, I mean, it was a fantastic experience. I loved the show, and I loved the freedom that David Simon gave the writers, combined with an attempt at real accuracy of what the city had undergone post-Katrina. Plus, I got to go to New Orleans and, you know, eat and hang out and then go on location. It was great.
Eat and hang out with a lot of great writers, you know. So.
Great writers, great musicians. You know, I wrote the episode with Fats Domino in it.
Ah, excellent.
I called David Simon and said, look, how do I write this scene for Fats Domino? I mean, he's not an actor. I know he's getting old. And do I need to worry about his ability to memorize lines? You know, what can he do, can't do? And I was just very concerned. I didn't want to write any action or dialogue for him that would be taxing, you know, or out of line or anything. Just I was trying to be respectful. And I was told, well, don't worry about it. Skip that part. And whatever Fats does and says, we will add to the script later. And I thought, great, this is the best job I've ever had.
Well, nobody's going to complain about that, that's for sure.
No, it was a fantastic experience.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Offutt, whose powerful new book is My Father, the Pornographer, a Memoir. You can meet him Thursday, March 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Julie Smith, editor, and Ace Atkins, Nevada Barr, O'Neill Deneau, and Maurice Carlos Ruffin discuss and sign New Orleans Noir, the classics, Tuesday, March 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Sadie Smith appears as part of her residency as the Zale Kimmerling Writer at Newcomb College Institute. She presents a reading Tuesday, March 1st at 7 at the Lavin Burnick Center Kendall Cram Room at Tulane University. Genevieve Munson Trimble discusses in signs Afton Villa, the birth and rebirth of a 19th century Louisiana garden, Wednesday, March 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Anne Boyd Rue, reads from in signs Constance Fenimore Wolfson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist, Thursday, March 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Chris Offit, signs My Father the Pornographer, a memoir, Thursday, March 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Emily Barr discusses and signs Urban Revolutions, A Woman's Guide to Two-Wheel Transportation, Tuesday, March 1st at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Thursday, March 3rd at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Yuri Herrera reads from and signs his book, Signs Preceding the End of the World, along with Lena Wolf, author of Bret Easton Ellis and the Other Dogs, Friday, March 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Z.W. Moore signs the first in the children's book series Desdemona's Dreams, Volume 1, To Dream of Dancing, Saturday, March 5th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. C.S. Harris signs When Falcons Fall, the 11th volume in her Sebastian St. Cyr series, Saturday, March 5th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Poets George Gita, Kelly Harris, Nancy Harris, and David Rowe read their work at the Poetry Buffet, Saturday, March 5th at 2 at the Alvar Branch Library. There will be a book launch party for the book The Beauty Fools and an exhibit of multimedia installations and prints, Saturday, March 5th from 6 to 9 at Cudeo Art Consortium, 2033 Magazine Street. Katie Simpson Smith signs Free Men, Monday, March 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Manning Wolf and Bill Rogers discuss and sign Dollar Signs, Texas Lady Lawyer versus Boots King, and History Retweets Itself, Texas Edition, Tuesday, March 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. There are now Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sales all over town. The Algiers Regional Sale is open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday from 10 to 2. There's another at Smith and Lakeview, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday from 1 to 5. And the Friends sell books at the Palmer Arts Market the last Saturday of every month from 10 to 4. And watch for a pop-up sale coming to Norman Mayer soon. Also coming up this month, the Friends of the Jefferson Parish Library hold their annual book sale March 31st through April 1st at the Pontchartrain Center in Kenner. And the 30th annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival takes place March 30th through April 3rd. Some of the great guests this year include Megan Abbott, Dorothy Allison, Mary Badham, Rick Bragg, Alexander Chi, John Lahr, and Claire V. Watkins. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for a complete list of speakers and events. Also taking place that weekend is Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, April 1st through 3rd. Check out sasfest.org for complete listings. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.